Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Do you watch House? The season's finished, but Dr. House, played by Hugh Laurie, is a really popular medical detective series showing the American hospital system of your dreams. Four brilliant doctors on 24-hour call just to look after you, with Dr. House trained at Eton and Cambridge. They always identify the disease 42 minutes into the show. Well, Ockham's answer to House is Jim Leversley, and here he is with the setup.
In London, on the 21st of September, 1507, 500 years ago last week, there occurred the first cases of an epidemic of a most unusual disease. It wasn't the first such outbreak. That had occurred in 1485. Nor was it to be the last. That was to be in 1551. And there were two others in between. But as 500 years is a nice round figure, it seems an appropriate time to look at a condition the nature of which has beguiled medical historians ever since. It had no specific name, the basic pathology has never been defined, though theories have been forwarded, and it appeared out of the blue in 1485, disappearing back into the blue 66 years later, never to return. It went under the general title of the sweating fever, or pseudo-angelicus, and cut great swathes through the population of England, spreading alarm and despondency wherever it struck. In 1483, Richard III, younger brother of Edward IV, succeeded to the throne of England. He is said to have been thus elevated by dint of some skullduggery, which included murdering the two sons of Edward, so-called princes in the Tower, both of whom had a greater claim to the throne than did Richard. Such genealogy does not concern us here. The point is that it led to plotting against the new king. Foremost among the schemers was the canny Lancastrian Henry Tudor, Earl of Richmond, even though there were at least 16 more qualified claimants for the job. Henry raised an army of mercenaries in France, landed at Milford Haven in South Wales in early August 1485, and marched north, gathering supporters as he went. With the great unwashed army of freebooters, on the 22nd of August, he met Richard in Leicestershire at the Battle of Bosworth Field. Richard was defeated, even though willing, as Shakespeare had it, to trade his kingdom for a horse. The upshot was that the Earl of Richmond became Henry VII, one of England's greatest kings. Now, the point of telling you all this is that, though triumphant, what Henry did not know was that his French mercenaries carried a fatal disease. England was virgin territory for this new germ, and an epidemic of this mysterious fever promptly broke out with calamitous results. It arrived in London in mid-September. The death rate was horrific and included the Lord Mayor and six aldermen. Henry's coronation had to be postponed. Panic took hold, and thousands died, many collapsing and dying in the street. Business came to a standstill, and Oxford University closed down. It persisted for the rest of the year. Then, with the snows of winter, it disappeared, only to reappear, as I say, 22 years later and just 500 years ago. Good descriptions of the malady have come down to us, including several token signs distinguishing it from other infections. The incubation period was frighteningly short, hours. The outcome, normally fatal. There were muscle pains or myalgia, headache, abdominal pains, vomiting and delirium, followed by cardiac palpitations, chest pains, prostration, and rapid breathing of foul, loathsome and putrid vapours, as the contemporary writers had it. Very characteristically, there were cascades of malodorous sweating, which may have been due to pain, rampant infection or anxiety at the thought of the expected outcome. Its relentless progress could be completed in one day. One observer described how a group of seven London householders who, and I quote, did sup together before cockcrow the following morning, five of them were dead. There were no swollen glands or buboes, characteristic of plague, nor any hemorrhagic rash common in many fevers. The only advice given was to take to bed and encourage perspiration. On no account was the victim to sleep until 24 hours had elapsed. No immunity followed, and repeat attacks were common. Among circumstances favouring the condition were said to be excessive meat eating, lack of fresh vegetables, and, probably the most potent factor, lack of personal hygiene. It respected neither wealth nor station, but did predominantly attack males between 15 and 45. Parish registers were not established until 1538, so there was no way of quantifying the lethality of the disease. It was discovered some years later that the paper used for these early records did not survive storage, so from 1558 parchment was used. The last epidemic occurred 7 years before this, so records are scant. The 1507-8 epidemic faded with the cold weather, but further outbreaks occurred in 1517, 1528, and finally 1551. The 1517 epidemic was terrifyingly accompanied by measles, plague and diphtheria. In 1551, 900 people died in a week in Shrewsbury, and a local doctor, John Keyes, was to write, "Women fill the streets with lamentations and funeral bells tolled day and night." And then a very odd thing happened. In 1551, the curse disappeared forever. There is no modern equivalent, and nobody really knows what it was. It was not in the big league like influenza, typhus or plague, to which hundreds of thousands succumbed, but its rapid carnage within smallish, close-knit communities gave it a special ranking of horror. So what was it? The mortality pattern suggests person-to-person contact, with groups being infected simultaneously. On the whole, the young and old were spared, but as fit and healthy 15- to 45-year-old males commonly collected in alehouses and the like, they could easily spread the infection amongst themselves. Towns along main roads, especially at crossroads, such as Oxford, were hard hit. All strata of society were affected. During the 1528 outbreak, Henry VIII fled from London, leaving his future wife, Anne Boleyn, to languish in Surrey, where both she and her father caught the sweat. They survived. Henry's elder brother, Prince Arthur, allegedly died of the disease. That was in 1502, not an epidemic year, but the recorded symptoms were right, so it must have been a sporadic case. Young Henry married Arthur's widow, Catherine of Aragon. We all know what trouble he had in trying to divorce her and its theological outcome. If Arthur had not died, he would have succeeded to the throne, and the course of British history would have been quite different. Sweating fever presented like a viral infection, and in 1981 a researcher thought that from its explosive nature it was an arbovirus, or viral infection contracted from animals, especially rodents, via insects. The snag with this is that most such infections are associated with cutaneous hemorrhages, but these, according to contemporary records, were absent. Perhaps it burgeoned too quickly for such signs to develop. Then, in 1993, a theory emerged that it closely resembled hantavirus pulmonary syndrome. This was first encountered during the Korean War in the early 1950s and named after the Hantan River region of Korea. It is a hemorrhagic viral infection leading to kidney failure and a 10% mortality. The virus was isolated in the lungs of striped field mice, commonly found in the rice paddies. There's not much rice planting in Leicestershire, I can assure you. Human-to-human transmission has not been documented, and the theory has been discounted. A peridomestic rodent population expands during summer and early autumn when there's ample food. Then they migrate indoors, thereby, from their excreta, increasing a house's viral load. We know from Greenland ice cores that temperatures were falling in the 15th to mid-16th century, so domestic warmth could have been more eagerly sought. All pathogens need a minimum host population to sustain the longevity. It's no good completely destroying the very thing which supplies your food source. If a new bug comes along, death in the hosts increases, perhaps alarmingly as far as the germ is concerned. The new population's defence takes time to be fully activated, and the viral load, its virulence and the host developing resistance determine whether recovery or death is the end result. The rodent vector of a new virus may well have come over from the continent with Henry Tudor, and the golden span of 66 years, enjoyed by whatever caused the sweating fever, might have been just the time needed to build up sufficient resistance to wrestle the rogue infection to the ground. It was a terrible and frightening epidemic, even in a population used to disease nearly death. Even now, nobody really knows the cause, nor the exact role that rodents played. Just as difficult is nailing the circumstances that controlled whether the victim died or not. It certainly was not 100% fatal. Did it really disappear in 1551, or did it continue in ever smaller epidemics that went unrecorded or were swamped by the enormity of the big players like plague or typhus? Or did the germ-carrying rodent population itself die out, perhaps killed by the very thing they were carrying? After all, we know rats die just as readily from the bubonic plague germ to which they are host as do humans. The question is, will it recur and again ravage a population with no residual immunity? We do not know. What we do know is that there are precedences for diseases dying out, sometimes spontaneously, sometimes due to preventative medicine. For instance, in Europe, epidemics of the waterborne disease cholera disappeared completely between about 1500 and 1817. True, it rumbled on in India, where there was a catastrophic outbreak in 1817, and the British soldiers returning from that country spread it first into the Middle East and then Europe, causing deadly outbreaks in England from the 1830s for some decades. John Snow's famous removal of the handle of the Broad Street pump in 1854 subsequently led to public health measures bringing it under control. A disease which did not disappear spontaneously, but did so by human endeavour, was smallpox. On the 9th of August, 1721, six London condemned felons were inoculated with smallpox pus to prove the theory then going about that a dose of the disease would give immunity. The payoff was a pardon if they lived, and if they succumbed, well, that's life, or death in their case, and nothing was lost. They did live, and were released. The theory didn't catch on until Edward Jenner proved it in a scientific experiment about 70 years later. But that date in 1721 saw the beginning of the end of this historic scourge. The end itself came on the 26th of October 1977, when Ali Mao Marlin, a hospital cook in Somalia, was confirmed as the last person to contract smallpox outside the laboratory. I say outside the laboratory because in 1978, Janet Parker, a laboratory photographer at the University of Birmingham in England, who worked on the floor above where smallpox was being studied, fell ill with the disease. She died, and the virus was deemed to have come up through the service duct. The laboratory director committed suicide. This freak and tragic accident did not stop the World Health Organization in 1996 determining that smallpox no longer existed in the world. Epidemics such as sweating fever, smallpox, plague and their like affect not only families, communities and continents, but, as we have seen, the course of world history itself. Society has enough trouble as it is without the added burden of combating the far-reaching effects of killer epidemics.
The good Dr. Jim Leversley in Margaret River, Western Australia. His books of medical mysteries and celebrity maladies are well worth reading, as is our new Occam's Razor book, Lies, Deep Fries and Statistics, in the ABC shop now. Next week, Trouble with Birds in the Bush, Sue Taylor in Victoria. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.